Argument, United States versus Al-Zubari. Mr. Glavin.
Motion for acquittal because the government failed to meet its burden in establishing that the building that was burned was used for activities which substantially affect interstate commerce. Second, the court's sentence above the guideline sentence of Mr. Al-Jubari was unreasonable. And finally, the court erred in failing to grant Mr. Al-Jubari's motion to quash in its entirety. Turning to my first point, there are two ways in which the government could establish the requisite nexus to interstate commerce. First, they could show that the property was used in interstate commerce, or second, they could show the property was used in an activity which affected interstate commerce. Now, the district court noted that typically, in cases of retail stores, the government proceeds under the first test. However, they also noted that the government clearly chose to proceed under the second test, a fact that was evidenced by the fact that the government did not object to a jury instruction which read, the government must establish that the building was actively employed for commercial purposes in a continuing and substantial manner and not merely passively connected to interstate commerce. Despite deciding to proceed under the second test, the only evidence presented at trial was that of two individuals. First, Laura Mills, a shop clerk, testified that she bought some products from out-of-state distributors. The store's owner, Mr.
Well, look, they're not growing their own tobacco.
Yes, Your Honor, but the question isn't whether they bought any tobacco from.
They didn't get any tobacco.
Illinois doesn't produce any tobacco, right. Does it?
Zero.
None to my knowledge, Your Honor.
And this was not really an issue at trial, was it?
It was Mr. Al-Jubari presented a motion for acquittal at the conclusion of the government's evidence.
There wasn't any contradictory evidence, nothing weighing against.
No, simply that
it's a tobacco shop, for heaven's sake.
They also sold other items. And the question is not whether or not they sold any tobacco, which clearly they did. It's whether they sold enough tobacco to create a substantial connection to interstate commerce. There was no question to the quantity of tobacco that was sold, the value of products purchased in interstate commerce.
Did the defense ask those questions? Did the defense ask those questions?
Not to my knowledge. Additionally, though, the 8th and 11th Circuit have held that every building, every business, and every person in the nation have received money or goods that have traveled in interstate commerce. And thus, to meet the jurisdictional requirement, the government must show that the property has either a direct and regular connection to interstate commerce or a substantial connection. As Your Honors pointed out, clearly we're not saying that they bought tobacco grown in Illinois or that there was no connection to interstate commerce, but what we're saying is the government failed to show that this.
But they didn't. But nothing they sold was made in Illinois.
I'm sorry?
Was anything they sold made in Illinois?
Anything they stole?
Yeah.
This was an arson case, Your Honor. So there was nothing. There were no products.
No, no. What is the business? What is this store that was burned down? What does it sell?
What does it sell? Tobacco.
Well, all the tobacco comes from out of state. What did they sell that's made in state?
They sold lighters.
Liners.
Cigarette lighters.
Lighters.
Yes. Yes.
Manufactured in China, no doubt.
I'm not sure in the country of origin.
What else did they sell?
I'm not familiar with their full inventory, but what I know is that it's not the defendant's burden to show that this store was not engaged in interstate commerce. It's the government's job to show that this property has substantial connection.
Of course it does. I mean, most of its products undoubtedly come from other states or foreign countries.
Well, the only evidence presented at trial was that the store bought some products
sometimes from out-of-state distributors. However, even if the court finds that the government did establish the requisite nexus to interstate commerce, the court's sentencing of Mr. Al-Jabari to 110 months and above the guideline sentence was unreasonable. The guideline range for Mr. Al-Jabari's offense was 78 to 97 months. And while the guidelines are obviously no longer mandatory, the Supreme Court held in Gaul that the guidelines should be the starting point and the initial benchmark. If a court decides that a sentence outside the guidelines is warranted, it should, quote, consider the extent of the deviation and ensure the justification is sufficiently compelling to support the degree of the variance. Essentially, a major departure should be supported by a more significant justification than that of a minor one. The court, in this case, used three facts to justify its above-the-guideline sentence. First, the court said that Mr. Al-Jabari's motive was to harm a vulnerable individual without business insurance. Second, the court said that Mr. Al-Jabari had violent tendencies. And third, the court pointed to the fact that Mr. Al-Jabari had not accepted responsibility for his offense. The court erred in the application of all three of these facts. First, simply because the shop owner didn't have insurance does not make him vulnerable. It's very possible that a wealthy individual could not have insurance. But more importantly, as the Second Circuit held in U.S. v. Curley, in that case, the poverty of victim children was decided not to make them vulnerable because they were not selected because of that characteristic. The government makes no allegations here that Mr. Al-Jabari selected the victim based on the fact that he didn't have business insurance.
But just the fact that he was a competitor.
But that was not the reason the court gave.
It was one of his reasons. One of his reasons.
Isn't that a pretty good reason?
Well,
is that unreasonable as a basis for going above the guidelines?
I don't believe so, Your Honor. The court elevated Mr. Al-Jabari's sentence based on his leadership role and based on his obstruction of justice. But to say that arson is a serious crime, and to say that it's more serious based on to drive a competitor away as opposed to insurance fraud, they're both serious. Additionally, though, the court pointed towards Mr. Al-Jabari's violent tendencies. The only evidence presented was that in response to hearing that his competitor was starting a rumor about him, Mr. Al-Jabari stated that he hoped his competitor was hit by a train and burned in hell. Clearly, this is hyperbole and not reliable information to suggest Mr. Al-Jabari was likely to commit an additional crime. Mr. Al-Jabari had no criminal history, and there was no reason to believe that this statement that he hoped a competitor was hit by a train was evidence that he was going to go out and tie his competitor to railroad tracks or try to cause his death in any way. It was simply hyperbole in response to hearing that a rumor was started about him. Finally, the sentencing guideline policy statements explicitly state that the court may not depart from the applicable guideline range based on the defendant's acceptance of responsibility for the offense, which may be taken into account only under Section 3E1.1. Here the court does exactly that. They state that they're going to give Mr. Al-Jabari 2-point elevation for obstruction of justice, but that's not enough. They're going to elevate a sentence based on his failure to accept responsibility. I see him in my rebuttal time.
You're not going to talk about the layout of the store and stuff, about whether there's some sort of search area?
Absolutely, Your Honor. The search warrant, Mr. Al-Jabari's motion to quash should have been granted in its entirety for two reasons. First, there was not probable cause to establish that Mr. Al-Jabari's residence should have been searched. And second, even if there was, the evidence of the kerosene can and the gasoline can were not found.
What's so strange is how narrow the warrant was, right? You'd think the warrant would be to search the premises.
Right.
Why? I have to ask the government, why on earth would they just want to search the residence?
I mean,
he works there. He has access to all the premises. That's what I don't get.
And the court chose to suppress certain evidence that was found in parts of the retail store.
Yeah, really puzzling.
The court divided it up. He thought some was a living area, residence, so to speak, and some admitted some of the evidence from that. Then there's the dock area that seems to be a variable.
Right.
He said that would not be a good faith search, but it'd have to be part of the residence, which he concluded it was.
Correct.
Now, is that because it's possible the police did follow that in good faith? I think you object the fact that it was that was an error from the court to find that as part of the residence, isn't it?
Yes, Your Honor. And this court held in U.S. v. Walker in 2001 that the court must use a common sense approach in evaluating warrants. And in this case, the police walked into an area with an overhead dock door and a loading dock and then said that that was part of Mr. Al-Jawahiri's apartment because there were pizza boxes and a refrigerator. A common sense approach says that the part of the building that had a bed and a television, that was the apartment. And the part with the dock door, where all of the store's deliveries were received, was not part of the apartment, but part of the retail store.
Is that where the gas cans were found?
Yes, sir.
Is that? Can you get into the? Is that an entrance into the residence area through that dock area? I'm trying to understand the diagram here.
I believe you can. I think there's a map.
It's your appendix C, but I'm it. It looks to me, if I am reading it correctly, that through the dock you get into the what's clearly the residence, right?
I believe that's correct. Yes, sir.
So to get to the residence, you've got to go past and see those gas cans.
I think you can enter the residence from the separate.
But one way in which one can enter is through the dock area where they would see the pizza, the refrigerator, and the cans, right?
Yes.
Okay.
I see my time is expired. Thank you.
Okay. Thank you very much, Mr. Glavin. Mr. Peterson?
Good morning. May it please the court. It's the government's position that the district court properly denied.
Why was the warrant limited to his residence?
Your Honor,
what sense does that make?
It really doesn't make sense, Your Honor. The warrant was drafted by...
As it was local police,
right.
Yeah.
And in speaking with the assistant state's attorney, really had no good explanation why they didn't draft it broader. The affidavit, it's our position, would have given them probably
right, of course,
the whole
yeah.
building.
Mm-hmm.
But since they did limit it, we are limited.
You're stuck
by what
with
the
that.
Stated.
Right. Yeah.
So to answer your question... I have no good answer.
Right.
I'm sorry. But despite that, Your Honor...
As we've heard this morning, things happen.
Mm-hmm. Was Judge Hamilton correct that through the garage would be the normal entrance to the residence?
Through the garage?
Through the dock?
Through the dock, whatever. Through that docking area.
No, I don't think that would have... I don't think that was the testimony, Your Honor. There was a separate garage door where the defendant kept his car. And actually
no, but I mean the area that had the refrigerator and the cans and so on. Is this the usual way that you would go into his that he would enter his residence, or is it an alternative?
It'd be an alternative.
It's not the main. The main entrance would be.
There was. You could either go through the retail area of the store and go to this back area that is very large and open area, and then off that area, which would. On the defendant's appendix C, I believe it is, the open area would be exhibit, where it says exhibit 48. That's a large room. And then back.
Oh, I see. Exhibit 48 isn't his residence.
No. Where it says
it's at the lower right hand, where the pool table is and the bathroom.
The bedroom.
And the little bedroom. I see. Right.
There's an outside door to the bedroom, apparently.
Pardon me?
Going into the bedroom, there's a door that goes to the outside. Apparently you can get in that.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
So that would be the usual.
Well, I think the testimony.
That's one way in anyway.
I believe the testimony, though, at the motion to suppress was that that was not an entrance.
No, it wouldn't.
Come in through the garage door, which is
yeah.
at the top.
Well, there are other ways to get in. And I'm just saying that's, right. that it shows an opening. But the one that's marked pool table, there's an entrance, we'll say, above that. You have to take a left turn to go over to the dock area.
Right.
You'd have to go straight ahead to go to the garage. The court put the garage off limits as far as that. It said the garage was not part of the residence.
Right.
So what is the normal way, setting aside that you say that open door at the bottom is misleading. But so what is the natural way in which, or the normal way in which he'd get into his residential area? Would it be
either through the business or through the garage door, is I think what the testimony was from his father. His father testified at the motion to suppress hearing.
Well, then where is the where were the cans?
They were found in the area where it says Exhibit 46, red gas.
I know. So what?
It's a dock here.
It's right next to the area where the pool table and the.
But isn't that the alternative entryway into the toward
the garage door where it says Exhibit 46?
Okay, that's one. What's his
There's another alternative way through the overhead door. You could go through that way. You could also go through the where it says business. That's where their shop was. You could come in the front entrance to the business
walk
to the back.
I see. Okay.
So there are various ways that.
Let me ask you about the sentence. The sentencing bothers me. What particularly bothers me is that Al-Jabari he was denied acceptance responsibility, right?
Correct.
But then, so that, of course, you know, raised his guidelines range. But then the judge gave him the enhanced sentence in part because of his refusal to accept responsibility. Was the judge aware that he'd already been denied acceptance of responsibility? Did the judge know he was doubling the non-acceptance penalty?
Well, I mean, certainly the judge could consider the acceptance of responsibility in fashioning the sentence.
But the guidelines range already, his guidelines range had no acceptance of responsibility discount in it. He didn't get that discount. Was the judge aware of the fact that he didn't have the acceptance of responsibility discount when he ups his sentence because he didn't accept responsibility?
I believe in the record he indicates that the defendant who went through the guideline calculations did not receive any reduction for acceptance of responsibility. So,
well, what did he think he was doing? Right? Well, the guidelines has already taken account of the fact that he did not accept responsibility. Then the judge says he still has not accepted responsibility for this offense. Well, fine, but that's already been taken account of in the guidelines range. So why does that become a reason for going, you know, 13 months above the guidelines?
Well, because he committed obstruction at trial, he could not receive acceptance of responsibility.
Of course, that's not true, and we've been through that a lot.
Well,
it is not true. But in any event, that's irrelevant. Okay. Of course, he didn't get acceptance of responsibility.
But don't you have to confess to do that? It had to be a confession.
Or admission.
When you get acceptance of responsibility, you get reductions.
Correct.
In a confession, if it's an early confession, you get 3 points, and if it's later, you get 2. And maybe if they don't they go up to the last second, you don't get any. And then, obviously, this went to a jury trial, right?
Well, and as you correctly pointed out, Your Honor, there are circumstances where you can commit obstruction and not accept responsibility.
But see, the problem I have is this. It would be fine if the judge said, look, I know he didn't get the acceptance of responsibility discount because he didn't accept responsibility. But I think, you know, his continued, you know, his refusal to accept and so on is more serious than is recognized by the guidelines, right? So under Booker, a judge can have his own penal theory, and he can say, you know, for me, refusal to accept responsibility is the worst thing, and that justifies a much heavier sentence. But when you just read this, it looks as if he didn't realize that the defendant had already lost an acceptance of responsibility credit.
Well, I think as I indicated, he did indicate that he understood that the defendant had not.
But wouldn't you expect some sort of explanation? I know he has already been penalized for not accepting responsibility, but I want more of a penalty. That's what I'm missing here.
Well, the record shows what it shows, and he did not say that, Your Honor.
But and I also think what Mr. Glavin said was correct. You know, just saying, I hope he's gets hit by a train. There's nothing more common than to say, I wish someone were dead. We probably all have people we wish were dead. So why does that show a violent tendency when he doesn't... I mean, arson, of course, very serious crime, but that's taken account of in the guidelines. Why does this make it more serious? I mean, obviously, you're not going to burn down a competitor's business unless you're really angry. You want him dead, but you don't want to kill him, in fact. You just want to burn his store.
Well, I think, though, Your Honor, when you look at the some of the factors that the court considered, if you look at them in isolation, yes, some of them may not seem very egregious, or in the case of the statements that he made about his violent tendencies.
Well, they seem kind of naive, actually.
But if all the factors that the court considered are looked at as a whole, and the level of departure that was given in this case, which really was not very large, the high end of the guidelines was 97 months, and he imposed...
Well, you got an extra 13 months, and maybe you could... if the judge said, look, I think burning down a competitor's building is very serious... worth another 13 months, that would, even though the fellow has no criminal record, that would be fine. That wouldn't be a problem. But you worry that mixed in with this is the violent tendencies and the acceptance of responsibility.
Well, there are other factors, too, that the court considered, including the fact that there were two guideline enhancements, one for grading risk of death or serious injury, and the other for the arson being committed at a place of public use.
Yes, I know, but you don't keep multiplying, right? I mean, you don't want a judge to say, well, his guidelines range was jacked up by all these terrible things. Therefore, I'm going to give him an above guideline sentence, right? That's just illogical.
Well, I mean, if each factor though is a factor that increases the guideline range. And makes the crime more serious, I don't think it's improper for the court.
Now, wait a second. That doesn't sound right. Well, you're saying the mere fact that the guidelines range is high justifies the judge in going higher?
Well, there's factors that don't get considered because...
Yes, that's what we're talking about, like acceptance of responsibility. Was that considered?
Right, but the fact that the crime created a risk of serious injury or death, and that it was in the place of public use, only one of those factors increased the guideline range. They couldn't both increase it because...
Right. Now, that's fine to consider the un...
Right. And that was one of the factors the court considered. The other, another factor the court considered was the planning that went into the offense, in addition to the fact that the motive was not only for financial gain, it was to drive someone out of business, take his livelihood away. There was significant planning that was involved, including the fact that he created or was involved in creating the police diversion to get the police officer on the other side of town when the arson was committed. And that was another factor that the court considered that wasn't considered under the guidelines.
In that line, did he know the other party didn't have insurance?
There was no evidence that the defendant was aware that he was uninsured.
Because obviously if he knew it, then burning him down knows he puts him out of business.
Right.
But you say there was no evidence of that. Okay.
And if there's no further questions, then we would ask that the court affirm the conviction and sentence of the defendant. Thank you.
Thank you. Thank you very much. Mr. Glavin, do you have anything further?
Your Honors, all of your questions about what the judge knew, or about whether he knew that he had... denied Mr. Al-Jabari the 2 points for acceptance of responsibility, go to the fact that his justification was lacking. While opposing counsel may not think an extra year and a month in prison is a significant deviation, my client certainly does, and a major departure from the guidelines requires a major justification. And if we're here asking about what the court was thinking when they decided what the sentence was, then clearly the justification for going above the guidelines was not sufficient.
Well, what do we make of the comment that what he considered especially egregious was to this was burning down someone else's business to eliminate competition. Doesn't that give us enough of a clue?
Well, the issue here is that the district court was not clear on which of these factors it was using. Whether it was his violent tendencies, which I think we've established that statement was simply hyperbole and not reliable information.
Would you agree that if we were to remand, the district judge could simply say, well, yeah, what was really egregious about this was burning this down to eliminate the competition, and that's why the sentence is 110? That would be perfectly okay.
It may be, Your Honor. I mean, if the court sufficiently justify its reason for the sentence, then it would be appropriate. Additionally, though, opposing counsel stated that one of the reasons the court elevated Mr. Al-Jabari's sentence was all of the planning that went into this crime, but that was already taken into account when Mr. Al-Jabari received a 2-point elevation for having a leadership role. So, Judge Posner, as you stated, the court can't just keep elevating the sentence after it's already increased it. It can't increase the base from 24 to 26 and then from 26 to 28 and then use the reasons for elevating the sentence to justify it above the sentence guideline. So for the foregoing reasons, we ask that the court reverse Mr. Al-Jabari's conviction or, in the alternative, remand the case for resentencing.
Okay, thank you, Mr. Diamond. You were appointed, were you not? So we thank you for your efforts on behalf of your client. And we thank Mr. Peterson as well. Next case for argument, United States versus Tinney, Mr. Gaziano.